Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. My name is Martin Makarian, and today my guest is Jeff Rathke, with whom we will be discussing the German Awakening, or Zeitenwende in German, announced by Chancellor Olaf Scholz in 2022 and Germany's new role in Europe. Days after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia in 2022, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, new in office, gave the now-famous Zeitenwende speech to the Bundestag, in which he proclaimed a dramatic turn in German foreign policy and national security policy in response to Russia's full-scale aggression. The speech generated a lot of discussions and sometimes I would characterize unrealistic optimism. 2 years later, Germany has been at the forefront of supporting Ukraine militarily and economically, but as the war has turned into a war of attrition, Germany is still a long way from the ambitious undertaking of Zeitenwende and divided over the extent to which to support Ukraine. In this episode, we will try to understand Germany's role in the security architecture of Europe and within NATO, the practical implications of Zeitenwende, the war in Ukraine, and what the future holds for US-German relations and Germany's new role in Europe. Ultimately, the key theme of this conversation is to understand why Germany is important for Europe and for the future of transatlantic relations. I couldn't think of anyone more suitable to discuss this than with my guest, Jeff Rathke, the president of the American-German Institute, the only think tank in Washington, if I'm not mistaken, focused exclusively on Germany. Prior to joining AGI, Mr. Rathke was a senior fellow and deputy director of the Europe program at CSIS, where his work focused on transatlantic relations and U.S. security and defense policy. Jeff joined CSIS in 2015 from the State Department after a 24-year career as a Foreign Service officer dedicated primarily to U.S. relations with Europe. He was director of the State Department Press Office from 2014 to 2015 and was Deputy Chief of Staff to the NATO Secretary General in Brussels from 2009 to 2011. While in the Foreign Service, Mr. Rathke served in the U.S. Embassy in Berlin and was the Deputy Director of the Office of European Security and Political Affairs at the State Department here in D.C. Mr. Rathke, thank you so much for being here today. We have a lot to talk about, so why don't we get started, right?
Thanks, Martin, but please, Jeff.
Jeff. All right. Awesome. Jeff, I think before we dive into the discussion of how Russia's invasion of Ukraine has changed German perception on European security, I would like to talk a little bit about Germany's role in Europe more broadly and what Germany was doing in terms of defense and security policy before the invasion started. I think our listeners would benefit from, you know, understanding the context in which this shift was announced and is happening currently. So why don't you give us some insights about, you know, on this front, about how Germany was thinking about security and defense before the invasion started, and where really Germany's role was before the invasion?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's sort of two real turning points to think about. The first one you've already mentioned, which is the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022. But of course, the other point was the first Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2014. So I think those two points define the most important eras in Germany's security policy and in its view of European security. Before 2014, there was a hope, desire, and confidence in Germany, I think it's fair to say, that the structures and the ethos of the post-Cold War world were still valid. That it was possible to pursue security and to achieve security with low levels of armaments, that there was a prospect of broader political integration in Europe that included Russia, and of course within the European Union, the ambition for as it is written in the relevant documents, an ever closer union of the European Union. So that was the way Germans looked at Europe and their security environment, and it was a pretty favorable one. As German leaders said from time to time, that never in Germany's history had they had this good fortune of being surrounded by friends, and that really influenced the way people looked at European security writ large. Now, there were many others in Europe who didn't have quite such an optimistic vision of the trends in Europe. But we'll come back to that.
Right.
2014, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, especially the Donbas and the annexation of Crimea, was a wake-up call. And from that point, you see, if you chart Germany's defense spending, you see that it reaches a low point in 2014 and then is continually rising since then. A recognition that Germany had neglected its security and its security obligations, and that it needed to redress that. And that took a further turn, of course, in 2022. So I think it would be a little too simplified to say that all Germans thought the world was peaceful and harmonious until 2022, and now all of a sudden they've done a 180-degree turn.
Overnight shift, basically, yeah.
Right. It was not instantaneous. It was something that was happening for a long period of time, but it has intensified since 2022.
I want to come back to a point you made, and we've seen this with some Central and Eastern European countries and their leaders of having this kind of feeling of being vindicated for their kind of skepticism towards the kind of structures that you described that Germany felt secure in. Would you say Germany's position has come closer since 2014? And we've heard a lot of criticism of kind of German foreign policy even after 2014 from those countries. So what is your take on it?
Yeah,
since you're putting this on a continuum in a way.
Right. And if you were to kind of try to identify the mean German view of Russia and of European security, it is certainly a lot closer now to the views of the Central and Eastern European countries and the other countries on Russia's periphery than it was just a couple of years ago. That's undoubtedly so. Now, question, though, is to what degree German policies have shifted, how that has found its expression in the changed posture of its armed forces, the Bundeswehr, the degree to which Germany is taking on new commitments, the level of German expenditure, all of these things, you have a slightly different picture depending on which of the measures you're looking at. But certainly, you will find really no one in the mainstream of German politics who advocates the view that we heard until just a couple of years ago, that is, security can only be built in Europe with Russia. That is a way of looking at the world that has been pretty completely wiped off the intellectual map in German politics.
Got it. Very interesting. So would you say the Zeitenwende speech, the speech that Chancellor Scholz gave, which generated this kind of worldwide interest, would you say that was kind of the crystallization of this intellectual change in thinking about security and the role of Russia? Or was it was it kind of point that started it, essentially, in German?
Well, it didn't start it. I think Scholz captured the change in mood. And he gave it, I think crystallized, the word you used is a good word to use, because he didn't instigate that. He himself had tried to leave no stone unturned. In fact, he had gone to Moscow shortly before the February 24th
invasion. Yeah, we remember the pictures on the long table.
Exactly. I think on the one, whether he really believed that some kind of settlement with Putin was possible, or if he wanted simply to demonstrate that he and the rest of Europe had bent over backwards to explore any possibility of a resolution. Regardless, he had gone out of his way to do that. And so when he turned around 3 days after the renewed Russian invasion and outlined a program of really dramatic expansion of Germany's military acquisitions, its defense spending, and its role in European security, that of course caught a lot of captured that moment. And if you look at the way Chancellor Scholz's critics within Germany try to hold him to account, what they are trying to do is to say that he hasn't lived up to the ambitious policies that he laid out in his famous February 27, 2022 speech to the Bundestag.
What do you think of that criticism? Do you think it's deserved?
Well, everything is a question of compared to what? And if you were to ask the question, has Chancellor Scholz delivered every single thing that he promised in that speech? The answer is no. He hasn't been able to. Now, just to give one example,
right.
February 27th, he said that Germany, starting in that year and henceforth, would spend 2% of GDP on defense. Well, Germany was not able to spend 2% of GDP on defense in 2022 or 2023. We'll probably reach that level this year, 2024.
Okay.
That wasn't for a lack of wanting to. It has a lot to do with the difficulties of spending large amounts of money in a way that is, you know, controlled by the legislature and that acquires the things you want to acquire. You can't, you know, you could light a bunch of money on fire and then you could say you've spent 2% of GDP,
right.
But it's actually a lot harder than that. And so, you know, can you find fault with the failure to spend money as fast as they thought it might be possible? Maybe, but you've got to keep in mind the actual objective, which is for the German government to recapitalize its armed forces and to ensure that they are in the condition to deliver security for Germany, for its NATO allies, and more broadly, as quickly as possible and within the relevant security timetable. And that's where I think you can start to, you know, credible criticism. You can ask, you know, is Germany moving fast enough? Will it have the capabilities that it needs before Russia is able to threaten, you know, Germany and NATO, but also in order to support Ukraine, which, if you look at it the way I do, Ukraine is fighting not only for its own survival, but also for Europe's security.
Right.
And so there, I think you can question whether the way the German government has chosen to spend money and what it's spending the money on has been ideal in every circumstance. But that's, you know, that should by in no way be taken to suggest that Germany's not
right,
serious
justifying
about
yeah.
doing what the chancellor laid out. I think there is still a broad support across not only the government and the parties that make it up, but also the main opposition, the center right, CDU, CSU.
You bring up an interesting point, which I wanted to get to understand, you know, why Germany is not being able to kind of hit that 2% goal, which, you know, we keep hearing in the media. That's something that in the US politicians bring up all the time, and the US presidents have brought up in the past as well. And you kind of addressed it, but I want to hear your thoughts. Does the coalition dynamic play into this? The fact that, you know, you can't increase the spending on defense faster, or is this purely a matter of, you know, the budget and the way Germany spends on defense and, you know, other government expenditures? What do you think? Where does the coalition politics impact the way it's being done?
I think now and for the remainder of this legislative term, which will go until the fall of 2025, so another 18 months or so, there is no serious disagreement within the coalition that they need to spend money on defense and that they are going to spend at the 2% of GDP level. That's not in question. I think what is where the problems start to arise is the way in which the German government is going about it.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 2022, defense spending was done through the budget. There was a defense budget. The defense budget was appropriated by the Bundestag and was then spent. In order to accelerate the expenditure, keeping in mind that Germany has basically, it's not quite a balanced budget law, but let's call it that for simplicity of argument. Because Germany has this balanced budget requirement or limited borrowing, the way they chose to supplement funding was by creating an off-budget fund, stocking it with 100 billion euros, huge amount of money, and then using that to buy major weapon systems. So you've got kind of two different channels through which the money is flowing.
Right.
And that impacts the ability to plan not only for buying stuff, but then the money you need to run it. Mm-hmm. Maintenance, operations, the personnel who need to be able to operate it. So you've got these things on two different tracks, and that brings up the possibility of those tracks being misaligned. So that's a much more technical criticism within the overall framework of widespread support for Germany devoting the resources it needs to security.
Got it. I want to segue, since we talked about defense spending, into discussing whether, you know, we can talk about spending all the time and look at numbers, but what does that really translate into in terms of actual military capabilities, defense capabilities, and Germany's readiness for, you know, war? I think I read somewhere that Germany will have its first combat-ready brigade by 2027, if I'm not mistaken, which was a huge surprise to me. That, you know, the biggest economy in Europe, one of the most powerful countries in Europe, and definitely a leader in the EU, does not have brigades ready to be deployed. So where do you think the military stands in terms of its mobilization after the invasion of Ukraine and kind of following through with the political commitment of the leadership to implement a lot of this changes in policy and the shift that we're talking about?
So I think it's important to distinguish. So the phrase combat ready, this may go back to a statement from the defense minister, Boris Pistorius, where he used a German phrase that is really hard to translate mm-hmm. into English. And he used the word kriegstüchtig, which means capable. It's not just combat ready. It's being ready and prepared to fight. He was not saying that German military units are currently unable to do their jobs. In fact, Germany has made a number of commitments of high readiness forces. Mm-hmm. I'd have to look up the number exactly, but you know they've got a commitment of tens of thousands of high readiness forces to NATO in the coming years. So it's not that Germany doesn't have combat ready units. It is that the Bundeswehr as a whole. This is the criticism that the defense minister was articulating, that the Bundeswehr as a whole is not doesn't have the readiness and capacity to respond to a warlike situation.
Got it. So major escalation.
Yes,
yeah.
He's not saying just wait 3 years and we'll finally have some people who can be involved in combat. No, that's not it. And in fact, since 2014, and even more intensively since 2022, Germany has had Bundeswehr soldiers deployed in Lithuania. It is in the process of making that deployment essentially permanent.
Okay.
And this will be the first time in Germany's post-World War II history that they have had their own forces stationed on an ongoing basis permanently outside their borders. In other words, if you think about this, you know, from an American perspective, this is something the United States is very used to. We have armed forces in Germany, in Italy, in the United Kingdom, in Belgium, places where not only do American soldiers go to serve for a few years at a time, but their families go with them. There's a school where their kids go to school. It's an entirely different way of looking at things than just a deployment. And then you return when your deployment's over. So Germany is doing something like that for the first time in its history. It's doing it in a quite thorough, well-planned way, and in a way that frankly exceeds what other NATO allies are doing on the eastern flank. If you look at the Latvia and Estonia and the way that other NATO allies, which are in the lead there, are building out their presence.
Thanks so much for that clarification. I think that also highlights the extent to which, you know, reporting in the media can kind of blur the lines of what, you know, where things stand in reality. And that brings me to the point. I was recently traveling with some students, faculty from SAIS to Europe, and having discussions about the Battle of Britain. and, you know, kind of drawing the parallels to Ukraine, war on the continent for the first major war for the first time since World War II. And something that probably 5 years ago, a lot of people could not imagine is now talk of large-scale war escalating and spreading through Europe. And a lot of countries are kind of coming to terms with the reality that they have to be ready for contingencies and war generally, which also means implications for society at large, right? Mm-hmm. How ready Germany is today if a war were to break out in NATO countries?
You know, Germany is not ready in the way that it was during the Cold War, where the German army stood essentially side by side with the United States, ready to repel a Soviet offensive mm-hmm. through East German territory into the heart of West Germany. So the question is, what is the timeline on, and what is the threat that Germany needs to be prepared for?
Right.
And so Russia right now is not in a position to roll up to Germany's borders. Of course, they'd have to get through Poland before they could approach. But so the defense minister often talks about the time frame of roughly 5 years that Germany has to be in a position to fight a high intensity war if it were attacked, and that is the time frame in which, even in favorable circumstances, let's say Russia were to succeed in its effort to occupy all of Ukraine and wipe Ukraine off the European map, it would still require time to reconstitute, rebuild, re-equip its forces before it would undertake, be in a position to undertake another war. So that's what they're thinking about, and that's what is driving their acquisition timelines when it comes to both new systems like the F-35 aircraft that they're acquiring, or other things, helicopters, frigates, etc. So that is, that's really the timeline they're focused on, rather than the phrase you sometimes hear in English is, fight tonight. that's not the way they're organized now, but they realize they've got a long road to travel to be in a position to, to deal with the potential risks and threats that they face.
And that brings me to the war in Ukraine, which obviously is still the biggest, I would say, topic, and especially important this year with the upcoming U.S. presidential elections and the kind of state of transatlantic relations and the prospects of what it could be where Donald Trump to be elected again, re-elected to the office. Where does Germany stand today on the support of Ukraine? Obviously, we have seen some major, I would say, shifts in policy for Germany, especially given the historical context, in providing weaponry and defense support to Ukraine. But we've also seen some criticism of Germany on how far that support goes. Mm-hmm. And especially recently with major public remarks from French President Emmanuel Macron. I'm curious to hear, where do you think Scholz's government stands now? How does it approach the support of Ukraine? And my understanding is that Germany views the war in Ukraine in the existential kind of lens that a lot of other European countries do, especially in Eastern Europe. But I'm curious to hear, is that support still holding up 2 years into mm-hmm. the war?
So, like we were talking about earlier, everything comes down to the question of compared to what? Is Germany doing a lot? Yes. Germany is, by all measures, the second largest provider of international support to Ukraine after the United States. Now, if you wanted to be a little cheeky and you could say, who is the largest current supporter of Ukraine? Maybe Germany's in first place because the United States ongoing assistance to Ukraine is held up by the impasse and the unwillingness of the Speaker of the House of Representatives to put the Ukraine aid package up for a vote. But leave that aside. So Germany is the second largest provider of support. both military as well as broader civilian support. So that is pretty remarkable. You could say that it's appropriate because Germany is the largest economy in Europe. It is the largest European Union economy. It has the largest defense budget on the European continent. And so that is maybe natural. But anyone who's familiar with Germany's post-war and post-Cold War history, I think, would recognize that this is a dramatic turnaround. Even in the weeks leading up to the renewed Russian invasion in February 2022, Germany had such difficulty breaking out of its the restrictions it had placed upon itself when it came to arms exports, mm-hmm. that it had only provided paltry levels of support to Ukraine. And it was only after the after February 24th that Germany started supplying things like anti-tank weapons, and the scope and spectrum of capabilities that Germany is now providing to Ukraine is really remarkable. It includes battle tanks. It includes armored personnel carriers. It includes some of its most advanced air defense and anti-aircraft systems, as well as more, prosaic things that are no less valuable to supply the day-to-day needs of Ukrainian forces. So all that is a lot. The question arises, though, is Germany doing as much as it can? And this is where, again, where the chancellor's domestic critics, including from some in the parties that form part of, that form the coalition, have criticized what they see as a grudging, reluctant, slow response to particular types of more advanced weapon systems. You may remember, and listeners may remember, that about a year ago, this centered around the question of tanks. Mm-hmm. Yes. And Germany was unwilling to provide its most advanced tanks, the called the Leopard 2. And the chancellor only decided to provide those once the United States, President Biden, made a similar decision to provide American Abrams tanks to Ukraine. That was part of a political risk management calculation for Germany. And the criticism is that that decision was drawn out too long, and then therefore those tanks were not available at the time when they could have done the most good, and so forth. This same argument applies nowadays to the so-called Taurus cruise missile system, which is very similar to the system that is already being provided by the UK, the Storm Shadow, or the French Scalp. The cruise missiles are manufactured by the same company, MBDA, but they have different characteristics mm-hmm. and capabilities. And Chancellor Scholz has taken the position that Germany will not provide its cruise missiles to Ukraine. There are a variety of explanations that come up for why, but ultimately it is a balance that Scholz has struck because he doesn't want German forces to be involved in the mission planning that would be necessary for these cruise missiles to be most effectively employed.
And so essentially not having German officials and servicemen and military officials to be involved with Ukrainian military personnel in planning these attacks.
Yeah. Now, and the main reason for this is that under German law, any deployment of German forces into a kind of kinetic situation requires a mandate from the Bundestag. Now, there's an argument that, well, these people wouldn't even have to leave German soil. They could do mission planning inside Germany. That might be challenged in Germany's constitutional court by politicians who disagree with it. And so, essentially, that is, I think, the core concern that has brought Chancellor Scholz to this position. There are other reasons. You know, some people say, well, Germany doesn't have enough of these missiles. It can't afford to give them away. It needs to keep them for its own security. So there are a variety of other reasons that float out there. But the main one is this question of control over the missions that are planned and the need for Germans to be involved in that, and the Chancellor drawing a line there.
So we discussed some of, you mentioned some of the weaponry and defense articles that Germany has provided to Ukraine. Does Germany have the defense industrial capacity to meet the kind of this ambitious agenda that has been set by this Zeitenwende announced by Scholz? Or where do you see things that Germany should work on to meet in order to have that defense industrial capacity?
Mm-hmm. So German defense industry is quite capable, quite profitable, and has a very high reputation internationally. Germany is always among the top five or six countries for arms exports. If you look at the data of SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, they just released their most recent data a couple weeks ago. So Germany has very competitive, very capable weapon systems that it produces. I would refer listeners who are interested in this topic and who want to go deeper on it to a podcast done by Dmitry Alperovich, his Geopolitics Decanted podcast, in which he recently talked with the defense editor of The Economist, Shashank Joshi. And I think the phrase, that I forget which one of them used it, but that Germany and a lot of European arms producers, they produce precise, I think exquisite was the word they used, systems that are very expensive and that are very reliable, but are produced in relatively small quantities. And when you look at the usage rates of munitions in Ukraine's defense against Russia, it's out of proportion. And so the question is, how can German defense industry ramp up its productive capacity in order to be able to provide the types of weapons that Germany needs and that Ukraine needs and that other European NATO allies are going to need? And there's a lot of work to do. One example of this is the company Rheinmetall, which is Germany's largest producer of munitions and artillery ammunition in particular. They've just broken ground on a new manufacturing facility in Germany. They have ongoing production, but it's going to take at least a year, a little bit longer, to reach their new target output rates. And that means that Europe as a whole is falling short of its commitments. For example, the commitment that the European Union made to provide Ukraine with 1 million rounds of artillery ammunition, you know, per year. They're going to hit about half of that. So there's a whole lot of room to grow and a need to grow in order to meet those requirements.
Thanks so much for that very concrete example of how, you know, German defense industrial capacities stand and how we can improve that. Before, this has been a fascinating conversation, but before wrapping up, I really wanted to go back to what you said about the Abrams tanks and how Germany, you know, had that political risk management kind of calculus. And was waiting for the United States to kind of make that commitment as well before it would send its own tanks to Ukraine. This is something that I think a lot of people are thinking about. Would Germany step up if the U.S. formally or informally withdraws from Europe? Now, if you ask me, I think fears that the U.S. would withdraw from NATO because of some statements that we've heard and the kind of policies that would be pursued if Trump were to be reelected. There's a lot of unknowns there. But what we do know is that Trump has certain positions that he has articulated, and there is obviously legitimate concern in Europe of, you know, where the U.S. would stand in that case. And funny enough, we did an interesting crisis simulation last month at CICE where that was precisely the scenario that we were doing, actually, mm-hmm. and seeing where the new power blocks would be, how NATO would function within this. Where do you see Germany's role in that case? Would Germany step up as a leader? I mean, we see some statements from the French president and in what appears to be kind of this preparation in case such an outcome becomes reality. What are your thoughts on what course Germany might pursue?
Mm-hmm. Germany has its own parliamentary elections happening about 1 year after the United States election. So, you know, it's hard to predict how German politics may evolve. But if you look for data points and evidence, I think it's significant that in the last few weeks, even as the fate of the continued U.S. military assistance for Ukraine has, you know, been sort of dangling by a thread here in Washington, you've seen a hardening of the European and in particular Germany's position that it will continue to support Ukraine and that may require more efforts. So not only did the European Union pass a 50 billion euro assistance package for Ukraine just over a month ago, but if you listen to what Chancellor Scholz has been saying, what he's saying is that we in Europe need to be able to support Ukraine regardless of what others might do. He's clearly referring to the United States, even though he doesn't do so by name. And the point that Scholz has been making is that other Europeans should be doing more. That doesn't rule out Germany doing more, but I think it's an attempt to try to shape the European political discussion. That's not entirely inconsistent with what President Macron is doing. He's placing the emphasis somewhere else, but it's what you see in the French position is also a much more sober, hardened position toward Russia compared to what we saw when the war broke out in February 2022. So I think that when it comes to supporting Ukraine, I think European countries are going to continue doing that. Will they be able to do enough to help Ukraine vindicate its sovereignty and reconquer its territory? There, it depends on the ability to produce things to get them there quickly. And I think there are, you know, I wouldn't be completely optimistic about that. But the political commitment is there, and I don't think that's going to change. The broader question that you also ask, though, is what would happen in a scenario where the United States disengaged in some way from European security? Would Germany be able to cover that? And there, I think, you know, it's not just about the mass of military force that the United States contributes through its presence in Europe, where we have around 100,000 U.S. forces. It's also about the U.S. role as a nuclear deterrent. And if you look at the differences in French policy and German policy on defense issues, you see, you know, there are other factors, but one big factor is the fact that France is a nuclear weapons state and Germany isn't. Germany is a lot closer to Russia than France. And so, you know, that is a situation where Germany is reluctant to take on the leadership position in Europe. It will play a shaping and significant role in coalition with others. The recent meeting of the French president and the Polish prime minister with Chancellor Scholz in Berlin is a good example of what that might look like when it's working well. When you have the country most exposed to Russia, Poland, the largest European economy, Germany, and the country with the greatest strategic ambitions in Europe, France, coming together to try to emphasize areas of common ground. But you know, there's no way around it. This is harder to do when you have to assemble a coalition of many countries with differing perceptions of national interest, rather than relying on the United States as the right organizer of European security. So that would be a challenge like we haven't seen in Europe since the interwar period, and we know how inadequate the European response was then. The question will be whether that is enough to generate seriousness and an attempt to avert that kind of bad outcome. And there, I think there's a lot more ground that needs to be traveled before you can feel confident about that.
I can't resist but to ask, where are the discussions in Germany currently in terms of Germany possibly going nuclear? That's something that I feel like has come up in, you know, hypothetical scenarios, especially in the last century, after the two world wars, the Allies and the United States, France, and others. And back then, with the Soviet Union trying to keep Germany down, as the first Lord Secretary of NATO said once. What do you think, do you think that's a plausible outcome that might come out of this?
I think it is absolutely implausible. I think that people who talk about Germany becoming a nuclear weapon state are wasting their time, their neurons, and their breath, because it's based on an inaccurate understanding of what is at the center of German statehood after the Second World War, and that is its constitution or basic law and its adherence to its international obligations. Germany has signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Germany, in its in the treaty on German unification, the so-called 2+4 treaty, it reaffirms those commitments. And so there is, it would take an absolute collapse of Germany's existing political system in order for the circumstances to arise in which a German government could pursue nuclear weapons.
Nuclear, yeah.
Now, from producing nuclear weapons is not that technically challenging. You see many countries with much lower levels of development that are able to do so. But Germany has also gotten out of the nuclear energy industry. It just closed its last three nuclear power plants.
In contrast to France, which relies heavily on nuclear
energy. So even from the point of view of the technical capacity, of course, there are plenty of knowledgeable scientists, but you don't have the infrastructure that you would need as well, even if you were pursuing some kind of a covert program, which, again, is anybody who knows anything about the way Germany acts internationally, that's unthinkable. So I think that is a complete dead end. But there is a really serious point there, and that is Germany relies on nuclear deterrence, even though it is not a nuclear weapons state. And right now, that nuclear deterrence is provided by the United States. If the assurance of U.S. extended deterrence for Europe disappeared, then Germany would have to find a different way to deal with that situation. So there have been at times speculation about the possibility of the French nuclear deterrent taking on a broader role than simply for French national security. And I'm sure you've got maybe that's a future discussion for
episode,
the podcast.
Yes.
is strategic stability and the role of the French and British nuclear deterrence in European security. So that's a serious question that deserves a lot of careful thought about how you could and what the French willingness is to extend in some way its nuclear deterrent in a broader sense. That's never really been tested, and it's something that deserves careful thought. But Germany developing its own nuclear weapons, it would be an entirely different Germany that would.
I appreciate your insights, because it has started to come up a lot more often, I would say, in kind of both expert discussions, but also in the media. So it's great to hear from someone, you know, who has decades of experience in European affairs, whether Germany could potentially go nuclear. To wrap up this very interesting conversation, I wanted to ask one last question. Does Germany have a new role in Europe in 2024, 2 years after the Russian invasion of Ukraine? And if so, what do you think that role is?
Well, I think, I'm not sure the role is different exactly. Germany is, in my view, Europe's indispensable power. That doesn't mean that Germany can do things alone. It doesn't want to do things alone. But it means that it's really hard to do much of anything with any ambition in Europe, whether that's, you know, in terms of security policy or foreign policy or its external economic policy, without Germany being at the center of it and actively promoting it. So that has been a feature of the European political landscape ever since Germany joined NATO in 1955. And that hasn't changed. What's changed are the circumstances and the threat to which Europe has to respond. So the things Germany has to do are different. The role maybe is not so different, but struggling to find the new policies that are appropriate and effective in this security environment is the real challenge that not only Germany, but the rest of Europe and we here in the United States now have to struggle with.
I think this is a great point to end the conversation. Jeff, thank you so much. Jeff Rathke from the American German Institute for you. For all of our listeners out there, Small World, Big Problems is a student-led production sponsored by the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University's Paul Nitze School of Advanced International Studies, located here in Washington, D.C. Small World, Big Problems can be found on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to become part of this podcast, suggest a guest for the show, or just send us your feedback, please email us at saisstrategypodcast@gmail.com. This episode was researched and produced by Andrew Whelan, Luke Lytle, my great teammates, and me, yours truly, Mark Makarian. I would also like to thank the Merrill Center staff and faculty for their support. We will be back soon with a new episode. See you all soon.
Thanks, Martin.
Thanks, Jeff.